Hi, this is Dr. David Stevens, your host of Christian Doctor's Digest. You know, I always consider it a privilege to have the opportunity to sit down with you and delve into the issues of your life with some special guests. And on this Christian Doctor's Digest, we're really going to focus on some of the issues that are affecting you every day. We're facing enormous challenges in medicine. We're facing enormous changes in medicine. But we also need to remember there's some constants, some foundational principles that flow through healthcare that we need to hang on to. On this issue, we're going to look at three of these topics. First of all, we're going to look at professionalism, that constant, that foundation that we need to hang on to. We're not in a service industry. We are a professional. We have a covenant relationship with our patients. And we're going to talk about how we can strengthen that and make it more vital in our lives. And then we're going to look at a different practice model. We've been kind of doing this over the summer in today's Christian Doctor and Christian Doctor's Digest. And the question I would ask is, rural medical practice dead? Is the small group practice no more? And we're going to get into an interesting conversation with someone who's still practicing that way and the principles that they follow that have helped them do that. And then we're going to finish up with Bob Orr talking about same-sex marriage and our new statement that's now online and available to you to help you think through and articulate this issue. So we've got a rich lineup of topics. Let's go talk to our first guest. A little different introduction with this segment because I didn't do the interview. Let me introduce to you the interviewer, who was Dr. Gene Rudd. And Gene is the Executive Vice President here at CMDA. He's an OBGYN doctor and my best friend and neighbor, and we really run CMDA together. I was in France visiting my kids and grandkids. They're there in language school heading to the mission field. So I don't make any apology that I wasn't able to do this interview. I just appreciate the fact that Gene did it and did a great job. You're going to enjoy what you hear.
Warren, thanks for joining us on this edition of Christian Doctor's Digest. You know, our primary goal here is to get to discussion of some of the concepts that you've published on professionalism, published in the medical literature. But on our way to that, I'd like to ask you to share a little bit about your journey, your background that laid the foundation for your perspectives on this. Now, you've got a dual appointment at Duke in both the School of Divinity and both Department of Psychiatry. And you took your undergraduate training at Furman and then went to Harvard for medical school, back to Duke for psychiatry, and then back to Harvard. And in the midst of all that, you got a master's and then a doctoral degree in theology. And I've probably left something out. But that's quite a pedigree. So what promoted you or encouraged you, directed you to take a detour from medical training to get this formal theological training?
My story is very much bound up in a set of questions that I really began to engage when I got to medical school, and that was actually in large part through the work of a Christian community in Boston called the Longwood Christian Community. There was a CMDA staff member who had just arrived in Boston a year or two before I got there, Bill Pearson, who was an incredible mentor to me when I was in medical school, and many of the relationships that I formed there are still continuing. I did go to Furman as an undergraduate, and I didn't have a lot of background in theology, but I got to Harvard Medical School and began to realize that although even as a first-year medical student, I could understand the empirical literature in medicine, that I didn't have the kind of theological base that I wanted to have to think through what was happening in clinical practice as a Christian. I did some shadowing in a detox facility in Boston and began to ask questions of, like, what do you make of addiction theologically? And is it a sin? Is it a disease? Is it both? And that led me to go initially to the Divinity School Library at Harvard, and I pulled a book off the shelf and began to read about the history of Christian discussion about sin. And I read about the debates between St. Augustine and the Pelagians in the 4th and 5th century and began to realize that although it still wasn't easy to make sense of addiction, there was a 2,000-year history of Christian reflection about these issues that are absolutely central to what we do in medicine, not just in mental health, but in other areas of medicine as well, that I wanted to know about and I wanted to be able to think about. And I felt called to think about that in a more structured way. That eventually, through a series of paths, led me to take 2 years away from medical school to do a master's theological studies at Duke Divinity School. I finished that, went back and finished medical school, came back to Duke and did a residency in psychiatry, and then did a PhD, a doctor of theology after that, to enable me to be able to teach in a university context on a divinity school faculty. So now I'm duly appointed in the School of Medicine and also the Divinity School at Duke, and my clinical work is at the Durham VA Medical Center. But it really started as a medical student trying to think, how do I make sense theologically of what's going on in medicine, and then feeling a particular call to think in a more structured way about that, which not all physicians do, but that was what I discerned to be my calling at the time.
Well, indeed, I find that a lot of physicians don't think about this. You ask some big questions in your writing: what is health? What is human flourishing? And it just seems to me the metaphysical questions that you're willing to tackle are things that are getting pushed aside in our highly mechanistic, highly technological world of healthcare today. Do you see it that way?
It's interesting. As a medical educator now, I frequently ask medical students and residents and even practicing physicians, when in the context of your medical education were you ever asked to define health or even to describe health? And in my case, it was actually in my third year of psychiatric residency that somebody in a formal curricular context that was part of my training asked a group of people, what is health? And then what is mental health? And how would you describe that? It never happened before. And I was actually attending to those questions because I was listening for it. And it never happened before. And maybe some are more fortunate than I was. But I find that in medicine, we talk a great deal about what is disease and what is pathology. We spend an enormous amount of time thinking through specific treatment approaches for specific conditions. But what we don't do is sometimes step back and say, what's health? And if you go to even definitions of health, either it's defined in some way as the opposite of disease, which is a circular way of defining it, or it's defined as a kind of overall, so the World Health Organization, that health is not just the absence of disease, but the presence of social, psychological, physical, and spiritual well-being, which is, again, kind of so broad that it's hard to know what's really meant by health. My suspicion within as to why doctors as a whole don't talk more about what do we mean by health is because if, as a profession, we began to talk in more detail about the specific shape of health, what we really meant when we talked about it, and especially when we get into terms like mental health or spiritual health, then what would start to happen is that we would start to have actually different ideas about what that looks like, that some people might disagree about what health looks like and might disagree about the shape of that. And so that would actually force us into disagreement. We can agree what disease is, but we can't agree what health is, and so we don't talk about it. So as a way to preserve a semblance of harmony within medicine as a whole, we focus more on pathology than we focus on flourishing or health, because that's when you start to get into contested ideas about what a good life looks like. What are humans for? What's life for? What's the shape of a well-lived life? Those are questions that Christians are used to asking, or at least should be used to asking, but that don't often happen in the context of medical education.
How common do you think this conflict has been throughout the history of modern medicine? Let's say 2,000 years, that's a little bit more than modern, but is this just a product of our time, our pluralistic, our relativistic society? Are we just now having the problem of being unwilling to discuss what health might be because it would include spiritual health, and we don't have the foundation or the common ground in our culture to discuss that?
It's not clear to me that medicine itself ever had much more robust ways to talk about health than it does now. But what is different in our culture is that medicine has much more social power to determine ways that we understand ourselves as bodies and as lives than it ever did before. So I think the culture looks more to medicine for morally guiding language than it ever did in previous centuries. Whereas in previous centuries, you had much more prominent narratives of religion, of faith, and even of various kinds of cultural philosophical ways to understand what well-being is. In our last 100 years of cultural history, increasingly medicine, in part psychiatry and in part other areas of medicine, have been looked to provide prescriptions for what it means to live well. And what that means is that medicine has taken on a higher level of moral leadership in the culture to be able to provide ways that everyone understands what the well-lived life looks like, and that's not, I think, a burden that medicine bears easily. Mm. What you find in previous centuries is that, for example, the reason why we have charity hospitals, and by charity hospital I mean a hospital that exists to take care of people because they're sick and not because they're soldiers or because they have money and can pay, but the charity hospital as being a place that you come when you're sick and people take care of you because you're sick is very much something that emerged historically in the context of Christian faith. In the 4th century, the communities organized by St. Basil in what's now Turkey began to develop what they called xenodokeia, or houses of strangers. And they began to take in people who were indigent, who were poor, who needed, who were homeless, and who were sick. And they began to provide infirmaries to care for people who were sick, not because they had money or because they were influential, but because they were sick. And the reason was because Christ is in the sick, and Christ shows up in those that are ill, and you take care of those that are ill as Christ does. And there's a direct historical line between those 4th century, very humble communities set up in what's now Turkey and the modern hospitals in which all of us that work in hospitals now work, in my case, Duke University Medical Center and the Durham VA. These are charity hospitals that very much have Christian roots, but no longer know how to narrate that history or how to claim that in any theologically specific way.
So it was the teachings of Christ and those who followed those teachings who implemented that spirit of compassion and reaching out to the poor and the infirmed, certainly modeling Christ in terms of both teaching the gospel and healing the sick as he sent his disciples out to do. Not a bad model for us to follow today.
No, it's not. And you know, other religious traditions had also developed ways of caring for the sick. It's not that only Christians did that, but in our Western context, our way of organizing medicine, and specifically the way that we think of nowadays with, say, the Entala Law, if somebody shows up in an emergency room anywhere in the United States, you can't just turn them away. If they're sick, you have to actually evaluate them and provide appropriate emergency treatment. And it's against the law to just kick people out on the street. Now, that's a law that reflects a certain kind of moral commitment on the part of a culture that it's wrong for hospitals to dump patients on each other, and it's wrong for hospitals just to turn people away because they can't pay. That's a moral commitment that has a very specific theological history that emerges originally from these communities of Christian practice. So it's not that people in other religious traditions didn't have any way of narrating this, but I do think that within our Christian tradition, there are particular ways of narrating it that have to do with that Jesus shows up in the sick that are centrally important for Christian physicians now to be able to reclaim so that we don't get, you know, burned out and overwhelmed by the institutional realities of modern medicine.
Well, your comment has sort of steered me back to the topic that we intended to talk about, and that's professionalism. When you said that we have rulemaking now in our society that tends to institutionalize what ought to happen because of the principle. And I know that rules in a society, the laws that are passed by a society, ought to reflect the virtue, the principles, the values of the majority of that culture. But also we sometimes have rules because we don't embrace them, or at least not everyone embraces them. So we have to have rules that tells hospitals you can't do something wrong, and we think it's wrong for you to turn your back on those who are in need. So we have some rules for that. But where does professionalism fall in this? Is it just a set of rules, or is it something more fundamental? You know, my aha moment with this actually occurred because of something you wrote in 2007 in the Journal of Academic Medicine, the article, Professionalism in Modern Medicine, Does the Emperor Have Any Clothes? And you talked about virtue as being the important foundation for professionalism, but you also outlined that medicine lacks sufficient resources within itself to produce that virtue. Explain what you meant.
You know, there's been a lot of effort on the part of medical schools specifically to inculcate values of professionalism in medical students and also in residents. And that has a particular kind of context that there's a sociological theory of professionalism, the idea that medicine, law, and clergy, and maybe some other practices as well, are called professions. And what it means to be a profession sociologically is that the broader lawmaking bodies leave you alone to self-regulate. If, as a profession, you can regulate yourself and can then act in the best interests of society, that would be what's called a social contract understanding of professionalism. Now, that's a sociological theory, but what that means is that if physicians don't act professionally, which means that if they're not perceived as acting in the best interest of their patients or in the best interest of society, what happens then is other people come in to make the rules for physicians. So if you have a lapse of judgment, an ethical lapse on the part of a particular physician, or especially if it's a pattern, then you see increasing external rules, maybe from health systems or maybe from other kinds of legislation. So that's not what medicine wants. We don't want extra rules on us as physicians. So one idea is that we need to actually be able to govern ourselves through medical boards And also, especially to make it such that physicians are acting in a way that those rules aren't actually necessary. How do physicians just act instinctively in the way that's in the best interest of patients and take care of people well? There's been a lot of effort to try to figure out how do you make medical students and residents more able to act in ways that we understand as professional behavior, to act with kindness, to act with respecting the dignity of patients, to act in the best interest of patients, to have good patient-doctor relationships. And what happens often in medical training, which has been widely documented, is that it actually goes the opposite direction. People come into medical training very idealistic, often having done pretty significant kinds of social service activity. And then by the end of their 7 to however many years of medical training from medical school and residency, people are much more cynical. They're much more interested in just navigating power relationships, much more technologically focused, and much less interested in spending time with patients. And there's a phenomenon for that called the hidden curriculum. People say that when medical students and residents get on wards and they begin to learn bad habits from their senior residents and sometimes attendings, that leads to a kind of moral deformation where people unlearn some of the idealistic traits that they carried with them into medical school. So there's been this effort to try to, well, how can medical professional bodies, how can medical schools try to remedy that? So you've seen a response in some medical schools to institute curricular efforts at in professionalism. You might have a class in professionalism. You might have a class in patient-doctor relationship. You might have a class in spirituality. That's another approach. There's various kinds of efforts that have been made, and those are not bad things in themselves, but they've never been shown to be very helpful, and often actually they're greeted with cynicism, especially by those medical students who might need them most, who are already becoming cynical. And so there's this conundrum within modern medical education that, you know, we all know that doctors need to be more professional, but it's hard to know how to implement that in a large-scale way that makes a difference. And my thought is that maybe the answer is in the wrong place. Maybe the answer doesn't come from medical school administrators implementing curricula, but maybe it comes from really needing to think on the very basic ground level about the kinds of communities that medical students and residents and practicing physicians are formed by. So as a Christian, would immediately leap to the kind of theological account of that, of the church as a nurturing ground, a place where physicians are nurtured to see Jesus and the sick, and to understand their medical practice as a kind of vocation, or even a kind of participation in God's healing work in the world. And that can ground certain ways of thinking about medicine that can actually keep a physician thriving in medicine, even amidst huge external and internal challenges. Not that it's always easy, but that the Christian tradition provides resources to be able to do that. And not just provides theoretical resources, like not just kind of theological ideas, but provides a community so that if our tradition is right, that, you know, we are all constituted in the body of Christ, that you are all members of the body of Christ, and we're part of a body together. And that means that even a physician who feels pretty isolated in professional practice isn't alone if we're part of a body. So how can churches and congregations and Christian communities be the kind of bodies that can help physicians and nurses and other health professionals to be able to continue to practice in ways that honors the dignity of patients?
One of the hot topics today in healthcare is right of conscience, not just in healthcare, but all of society. How do you see this interface between professionalism and right of conscience? Some are actually suggesting that professionalism requires us to check our conscience at the door.
So along with others that have written in this area, I have a very high view of conscience. I actually don't want to separate conscience too closely from clinical judgment. Conscience is part of how we're organized as human beings to understand what the good is in any particular situation. And it's a kind of knowledge that we have certain knowledge about the world, and part of our knowledge about the world is what's appropriate and what's not, what's right and what's not. And acting against our conscience is to act in some way, in a way that we know to be wrong. And by wrong, I mean as the opposite of right in terms of knowledge, that we're making an error in some way. So to ask a physician to act in a way contrary to his or her conscience is, I think, the same thing as asking a physician, well, in this particular case, why don't you actually not do what you think clinically to be the best thing? Why don't you act against your best clinical judgment in this situation? Or why don't you intentionally do something that you know not to be best? Mm-hmm. And that's not something a physician should ever be asked to do. Now, of course, there are times when a physician might be in a situation where there's a matter of you know, something that might come up that could go either way, and there's a discussion then about that. This can be a matter of negotiation with a physician and a patient or with the physician and his or her employer. But if a physician has a deep-seated sense of conscience that a certain act is not consistent with excellent medical practice in this situation, then for a healthcare system or for a governmental agency to require that physician to act in a way that he or she believes strongly to be inconsistent with good medical practice is, to me, a really deep threat to medical professionalism in that sociological sense, that it's making physicians a tool of organizations or of the state in a way that I, as a physician, don't want to be made of. And I say that with great respect for the complexity of the way that these things come up, and not suggesting that that's a simplistic answer, but also wanting to place a high value on conscience as a kind of knowledge that is akin to what we think of as clinical judgment. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't ask doctors to do something against their clinical judgment. At the same time, I think that the word conscience is not to be used as lightly by physicians. So if we're in a situation where we're abstaining from a certain practice for reasons of conscience, we have to really search ourselves and think, is this something that is the appropriate measure in this case? So it's not something that I think is just something to kind of, you know, use as a first line, you know, invocation just because we feel uncomfortable with something, but it is, I think, something that's deep. And so to ask somebody to do something against their conscience seems to me is deeply problematic for any classic understanding of what it means to be a part of our profession.
I understand that you will soon be able to work, if not already, be able to work more closely in collaboration with Farr Curlin, another fellow
Absolutely.
Who I value greatly because of his work and writing and research in faith and health. And Farr is either there or coming there. And what do you
yeah.
guys, without telling any secrets, what you guys got coming down the pike?
No, thank you. I'm really delighted to be able to talk about what we're doing at Duke and the Divinity School. As I said at the beginning of the interview, I have a joint appointment at the School of Medicine and in the Divinity School at Duke. I'm joined actually by three other physicians on the Divinity School faculty, which is unique among American seminaries and divinity schools, I believe, into having that number of clinicians that are on the faculty. So I'm joined by Farr Curlin, who has recently moved to Duke from the University of Chicago, by Ray Barfield, who's a pediatric oncologist and also a Christian philosopher, and by Richard Payne, who's a palliative care specialist who's done a lot of work in faith-based communities and end-of-life care, and by a lot of other colleagues on the Divinity School faculty that care in various ways about health and medicine and illness. And as a part of our work together, drawing on some things that have gone on at Duke in the past, we're starting an initiative that we're calling Theology, Medicine, and Culture that is not a single program, but it's an umbrella into which various kinds of programs can fit. But one of our strong commitments in the Divinity School is to create spaces for clinicians or medical students or pre-med students or people from other health professions who desire theological formation, who want to think about medicine in a specifically Christian way, to come and to participate and to participate in a community of conversation and formation that can allow for that. We have a number of degree programs that are offered, and we also have other kinds of programs that we will be launching that will give physicians a way to kind of tie into what we're doing. And this actually draws from some of the things I was saying early in the interview, that being in a divinity school context that's closely linked in a university to a medical center allows us to have a kind of freedom to think specifically internally to the Christian tradition that we wouldn't have if we were only within a medical school that's, in our case, of, you know, secular research university. But in the Divinity School, we can think, and we can think not just as clinicians, but we can think right alongside pastors in training and congregations and communities. So we have a vision for really thinking in the service of the church. How can the Divinity School at Duke be a resource for clinicians all over at various stages of training and in mid-career to capture more of a theological imagination for medicine and for the possibilities of the Christian tradition in relation to medical practice? And it's a journey with these colleagues that I'm really delighted to be on.
Well, many of us at CMDA are going to be eager to see how this comes about, this both the scholarship and the inspiration that comes from this model that you've created. It's an exciting time for you, and we're so glad you're getting this opportunity. Dr. Warren Kinghorn, thanks for being with us. It's been informative and inspirational. Appreciate what you're doing and pray God's favor upon you.
Thanks, Gene. Thank you for having me on.
You know, I'm excited with this new concept at Duke because it's really kind of an example of Paul and Luke getting back together. Luke traveled with Paul. In fact, he wrote more of the New Testament as a physician than any other author and was so inspired by God. And as we try to pursue this, even in our own communities, I think it can be a huge thing. In fact, with our Grace Prescriptions, the conferences that we do, we encourage physicians and dentists to bring their pastors with them and look where they can link up closer together. Also, professionalism is such an important issue. We've got a great resource to help you travel down that road a little bit further. It's called Practice by the Book, and it not only looks at professionalism, but many of the other issues that are foundational to our practice in medicine. And as we face these challenging times, it's so important that we're well-grounded in what we know and believe and understand are the framework of how we practice healthcare in this country. I encourage you to get a copy. It's available at 888-230-2637, or you go to our website, cmda.org, hit the resources button, click on the bookstore, and it can be coming your way before you know it. Not only are there a lot of changes in healthcare, there are changes in tax law and giving and all sorts of things going on in our country. So let's get together for another TaxWise moment with Jamie Campbell, our Vice President of Stewardship. Jamie, we're going to get into an interesting topic, how to be tax-wise in your giving now and beyond when you're gone.
Yes, sir. It's a question that a lot of people face. When do I do my giving and what do I give when? I have people ask all the time, how much should I leave? The real answer is you will leave everything, but I know what they mean. The other big question people should consider is what assets should I leave? So today I want to look at a tax-wise strategy about which assets might be best to leave to loved ones and which might be best to leave to charity.
Okay, get into that. Let's talk about while you're still alive.
Okay, one of the most overlooked assets that many of our members have is their retirement accounts, maybe a 401k, an IRA, or some other qualified account. These are easy to leave to charity because in most cases it's just a matter of naming the ministry of your choice or your church or some other charity as the beneficiary. So let's look at an example of two types of assets and when you might want to give each.
Okay.
Let's say you have a $1 million estate, half is a traditional IRA, and half is in appreciated stocks. If you want to give a significant portion of it away while you're still living, you may be best served by giving the appreciated stocks to ministry or your church or some other charity and leave the IRA to your family. By doing that, you will receive a tax deduction for the full current value of the stocks and avoid any capital gains tax while the IRA continues to grow tax deferred.
So that's a double blessing,
yes,
so to speak.
To you and your family who may incur some taxes otherwise down the road. If you intend to give most of your estate away at your death, the opposite might be true. Let's say you name CMDA as your beneficiary of your IRA and leave the appreciated stocks to your children at death. The securities will pass your children with a stepped-up basis. Your estate may still owe taxes on the value of the stocks, but you'll avoid completely the capital gains on the appreciation. If you name your children as your IRA beneficiary instead, they may pay income taxes on the money as they withdraw it from the IRA. So this is just one idea of looking at your retirement account as part of your estate planning.
Yeah. And you may pay no taxes at all if you're underneath the death tax max, which is still pretty up there.
Yeah, it depends on what year, you know, the state you live in, those kinds of things. You know, these are just ideas. We always encourage people to go talk to their individual advisors. Every situation is different, but it can make a big difference for both ministry. If you end up paying taxes on money before you give it to ministry, you're going to give a lot less, reap a lot smaller tax benefit, and the ministry is going to have a lot less money to do work with.
Being wise about your giving in this type of environment is important. And secondly, getting some good advice on what's happened, because things are changing all the time. And you're available to answer questions and also can put them in touch with people that can help them if there's questions you can't answer.
Absolutely. You can call us anytime at 888-230-2637 or send an email to stewardship@cmda.org, and we'll get right back to you, point you in the right direction, answer some simple questions. It's I have people come up to me all the time and talk about how much they appreciate this, and it just gets the wheels rolling, get people thinking.
And there's no cost to that, and it's no expectation that you'd have to give something to CMDA. That's just something I want to do for our members. And the other thing I would say, and I'm just getting ready to do this again, is every decade or more often, you need to be relooking at this to make sure that all your documents, will, and plans for how things are going to be distributed are accurate and match what's going on with changes in the law.
Absolutely. And as administrations change and Congress change, state legislatures change, the laws change. So what may have been perfect for you 10 years ago may not be so perfect today.
Yeah, and the children move out and, you know, all those other things.
Different needs.
Different needs. Jamie, thanks for being here and for all you do to help our members, and we'll look forward to our next time together.
Thanks, Dave.
It's a joy to welcome Steve Furr to the microphone. Steve's been a friend for many years. In fact, came a couple times when we were in Kenya and helped out for a month at the hospital, and we became fast friends. Great sense of humor, a lot of fun to be around, and a great physician. He's practiced in Jackson, Alabama for 30 years, did his medical school at the University of South Alabama and his residency and family practice at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. And he's married to his lovely wife, Lisa. He's had a lot of leadership positions at the state level, at the national level, both in his church as well as in medicine. President of the Medical Association of the state of Alabama, the Alabama Academy of Family Physicians, served as president, Alabama Medical Directors Association, and many other roles. Steve's just a great guy. And we're going to sit down and talk about, is small group practice still viable in the United States with all the changes in healthcare, so many people becoming employees? And just hold this out there as one of those options you may want to think about if you're just starting your career, or be reassured about if you're still practicing like Steve in a rural area. Let's get to that interview. Steve, tell me about how you ended up in private practice in L.A., Lower Alabama, not exactly the big city down there.
Well, as you know, I did a couple of months of mission work, you know, when I was a resident over in Kenya. And actually, I thought that's what God was calling me to do. But I actually also had a Health Service Corps scholarship. Come to find out, to fulfill that scholarship, you know, which you practice in an underserved area, you have to do it in the continental United States. So when I couldn't come to Kenya, a partner of mine, Sid Crosby, was looking for a place to go, and we came and visited Jackson. And Jackson's a town of about 5,000 to 6,000. And what was interesting is that one of their senior physicians just been kicked off staff for some issues, and then they had another physician that had died. So there was just a huge need in the community, and they'd also had the same issue that you often see in rural areas, that you had physicians that would come and stay 2 or 3 years, serve time, and serve whatever their commitment is, and then would move on. So it was kind of opportunity we were looking at. We wanted to do a full scope of family medicine, which included OB and take care of people from birth to grave. And nursing home was here, so it met a real need, and God just opened the doors, and we just felt very comfortable about that. So the two of us started, and then we've added doctors over the years. We now have 4 doctors and had 2 nurse practitioners. We just lost one of those. But most of that period of time, we've had around 6 providers in our practice.
What are the advantages, in your mind, of practice in a more rural area? You know, so many healthcare professionals now are employees as they come out of training, or even those that have come under a hospital or some other group, just difficult dealing with the bureaucracy and reimbursement and all that issue, and yet you guys have been able to make it work. How's that possible? What are the advantages? And we'll get into some of the disadvantages. I'm sure there's some on that list as well.
For us, of course, the biggest advantage is we've always been our own boss. You know, of course, there's a lot of things you got to look at and dealing with the government, that type of thing. But as far as setting our hours and what we want to do and see, and so each physician here has kind of been able to set their own tone of what they wanted to do. So, and what we've done with our practice is everybody's kind of subspecialized in certain areas. So with 4 of us, there wasn't enough colonoscopes for all of us to do it and be good at it. So we had one guy go off and train to do colonoscopes. So people can kind of get into their niche of what they want to do within our general family practice, we still all see a variety of patients, but people can kind of sub-diversify or sub-specialize within that. And we've kind of done the same thing as far as our outreach, as far as our Christian ministry part. We don't say you've got to fit into this niche. So everybody's kind of done their own things in addition to their practice. You know, one of my partners, Sid Crosby, is big in discipling other men, so he has small group studies here at the office on Tuesday mornings, and he changes that group around and brings another group in. So that's been his kind of thing where he reaches out into the community. Then one of my partners, Norm Stevens, he's big into mission work, so he takes a big mission team to Nicaragua every year and gets the whole community involved. So all the churches help get supplies and pull all that together. Then you have people in the community go, so he takes 30, 40 people every year. And then God's opened doors for me to do different things and organize medicine with the medical association and the medical directors, and also with some of the universities here. So neither one of us are doing the same thing. We know nothing's been a cookie cutter type thing. We've all found our own little niches. And what we've also done is we have the flexibility. If I need to be off 3 days this week because that's when the medical association's meeting and I need to go there for those meetings, I have the flexibility to do that. If I was in a straight corporate situation where I can only take X number of days off. So, you know, you've got some flexibility in the corporate situation. You might actually get more straight days because basically when I'm off, I don't get paid.
Right, right.
So that's the disadvantage. But I do have the flexibility, you know, other than taking my call days. If there's somewhere I need to be or there's something going on in the church at large that needs me there, I have the flexibility to kind of set those hours. You can't do that in a lot of jobs.
When you talk about organized medicine, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I've been the president of the state Alabama Medical Directors Association, which is essentially the nursing home medical directors. Then I've been the state president of the Academy of Family Physicians, and then our state medical organization, which is very strong. I've also been president of that.
You're just president of everything, Steve. That's
great. Know, like I said, God just opens doors, and I just kind of go through them. You know, it's not something I actually saw or actually even tried to get into, so I just kind of wait and see. And it's really been amazing how, you know, with the time pressures and that kind of thing and all the potential conflicts, he always just seems to work my schedule out. You know, I'm
yeah.
always where I need to be, you know, and I'm sure you deal with the same thing. You just say, you look at all the things you've got to do, and then what I've learned is if he's shutting the door, don't try and beat that door down.
Yeah.
Because you don't need to go there. I know there was a time we had a church meeting in the Philippines, and I really wanted to go and needed to be there, and I just couldn't get it to work no matter what I did, how I turned around. I couldn't get it to work. Come to find out, that was right when President Bush went into Kuwait and they shut everything down.
Yeah. You know?
So what happened, nobody got there except one guy. And what was interesting, so they contacted everybody on the commission, says don't go, and he didn't get the message. But I was actually away in Birmingham, and they would have not known how to contact me, so I'd have been flying over to the Philippines, not knowing the meeting had been canceled. So you just got to be sensitive to the Spirit, and if he's really, really closing that door, you don't try and knock it down.
Sure.
But at the same time, if he's opened the door, you know, even though it might require some commitment and some extra time, all these other things I've done is all have led to other open doors, you know, that I probably never had the opportunity to do. By doing those things, I'm now president of the Board of Trustees of the University of South Alabama. So each thing has led to another open door, and then I recently gave the commencement address at the University of South Alabama, and this all those doors he's opened and given a chance just to proclaim the word.
Well, I know you've had incredible influence, and I know you've gotten a lot of Christian speakers involved in academy activities and other things. I know I even had an opportunity to come down there and speak. So
right.
Talk about some of the other advantages or disadvantages. What about work hours? I mean, I know a lot of people are concerned in private practice that I just work myself to death and there's not enough people to handle it. And how have you all handled that? The other issue is how is a small practice in Alabama compete with the big boys as far as reimbursement from third-party payers and all that kind of stuff?
As far as the practice, what we've always done is we always have somebody designated to be on call. But essentially when you're off, you're off. So you don't come back in, you don't get called back in. So your family knows that when you've got an off day, you're truly off. And I think we've done that from the beginning. That's real important to your families to know mm-hmm. that if he's off this Tuesday, we don't have a set-off day. It varies from week to week, depending on what else is going on. But your family pretty well knows you're there. So whoever's on call soaks up all that extra. And then over the years, we've been able to get the hospital to help cover on the weekends and nights, so that frees up a little bit more time than what we used to have in the beginning. as far as competing with the others, you know, we don't have any competition in the rural area. So. Of course, the difference there is we pretty well see all comers. So we see Medicare, Medicaid. We see the no insurances. You know, I looked at our numbers the other day, and essentially 11% of our payer mix is now non-insured still, even with the changes there. So we see everybody that comes, so there's nobody standing in line to take our patients away.
Yeah. I know one of our members who started a Christian family practice in a major city, and the big issue was just getting reimbursement rates to sustain it, even though they had lots of patients and good professionals. But you're, like you say, in a rural area, you've kind of got the corner on the market. How's it worked with the hospital? Has that worked well?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the other thing I sort of mentioned. And part of being in private practice is you get to choose who you work with. And we've got a group of people that, you know, my partners are just great to work with, and the people we have in the office are great to work with. So you enjoy coming to work. You know, in an institutional, you probably don't have that much control over who you work with. But we do, and most of our employees have been here for a long period of time. We see it more as a family than just as a workplace. We celebrate birthdays and do things together, so it's enjoyable because, as you know, there's a lot of stress in what we do, particularly with all the environment that we're in now. So being able to come to work every day and work with people you enjoy seeing and working with makes all the difference in the world. But going back to the reimbursement, I mean, that still is a huge issue for us. And several years ago, we actually changed over into a rural health clinic, which allows us to get better reimbursement on our Medicare, Medicaid patients. So you've got to continue to look at the models that are out there and see what works so that you can make a go of it. Because, you know, the problem is medicine's getting now, you can be extremely busy and not make a living.
Yeah, unfortunately. What about the disadvantages? I've been in practice for 20 years, and I call you and say, hey, you guys looking for another guy to join you, or fresh out of training or whatever, and I ask that question, what would I need to be thinking about, the specific challenges of a private practice in a rural area?
Well, I think the biggest thing is your wife can be satisfied in a rural area.
Yeah.
There's a lot of advantages of being there.
But or husband.
Grow up in a, yeah, or husband, yeah. So if they're not from a rural area, and most of them, we think, enjoy that, but if they're not from that area, they need to decide that. Our schools, we feel like, are very good schools, and there's a lot of opportunities here. But if they're not from a rural area and they're used to having, of course, you know, now, for me, having the Internet is like the whole world's opened up to you, you know.
Yeah.
And I can airport's an hour away, and I can fly anywhere in the world I want to be. And, you know, we don't consider ourselves rural anymore since we have a Walmart here. So
They're everywhere.
That's right. But it does make a big difference in all
yeah.
of
them. And Amazon's online if you can't find it at Walmart.
Exactly. So. And you can get on there, and it's delivered right to your door no matter where you live.
Yeah. What else besides the family situation? I see some strong things in the schooling situation, because so many larger cities, the schools have gotten very difficult for a lot of people homeschooling for that reason.
Right.
But you tend to have better values.
Yeah, and actually one of my partners is homeschooled here, and they've done very well with that. You know, in fact, there's a pretty strong homeschooling here out, even here in the rural area. So they've done both and been pleased with both ways. And when they homeschooled their son for a while, and then he really got into sports and was a real strong athlete, he actually went to school. So they've done both and been pleased with both.
Any other disadvantages? If you were, you know, starting all over again, what would you be thinking about?
I think starting now, you know, just trying to look at the compensation and make sure you can make a good living. And I think, you know, as you're looking out there, look at the reimbursement models and how much are they going to change over time. I think a real key, though, particularly going out into a rural area, finding somebody you can practice with. We've always considered from day one, it's like a marriage. Is this somebody I want to stay married to for 20 years? So finding somebody that you can practice with. And then, you know, try not to get worried when they use the restroom when you want to use it, and vice versa. Not get upset over the little things and just worry about the big things, you know.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing is knowing that the other partners are Christians, that you can pray about things and work through things. And the same thing with the other employees, and that makes a huge amount of difference.
I see it as a huge advantage, as we face so many challenges to right a conscience now, especially when you're an employee. And as I was sharing before we started, just last week, a couple doctors that had essentially gotten fired because of their stand on right of conscience issues that were employees. So I think that's a huge advantage in this day and time.
I can imagine how that would fly, because I can remember when I was a resident and there was a lot of pressure as a standing practice resident. We didn't actually do the abortions but they wanted us to do the work of, you know, mm-hmm. of the people there and kind of be present when it was done. And I was a resident, and there were a couple of students, says we don't want to do that. And, you know, we got called into the dean's office and, you know, talked to. But we says, you know, we don't want to do this. If you're going to have us do the physical, we're going to talk about the other options.
Yeah. You know?
And, of course, this is a big moneymaker for them, too. You know, it's interesting. You know, I can imagine this day and time, they probably would have kicked us out of the residency. It'd be my concern. But back then, they just say, well, and, you know, it was interesting. They talked it over. And, you know, about 6 months later, they stopped doing it because, you know, they said, you know, if the residents and students don't want to do it and this is a teaching place, why are we doing this? So they just stopped doing it, and we were just shocked. You know, so, but in this day and time, whether you would get that kind of leniency is another whole ball game.
You were a testimony to them and got them to rethink it. Steve, if you were, as I said, doing it all over again, or looking back from where you are now, are you happy that you went this route, and would you encourage others to do it?
Yeah, I wouldn't do any different. You know, of course, things change over time, but, you know, I feel like I followed the path God wanted me to follow. I think the neat thing about a physician, you have so many opportunities out there, and you just need to pray about what you're going to do and see what doors God opens for you. And it's not all just about the money. You want to make a living and support your family, but also look at what you can do and be willing to do for 15 to 20 or 30 years. So the key goal for all of us in our life is seeking God's will.
Yeah.
And if you're in His will, you're going to be satisfied. And if you're not in His will, no matter how great it is and how great the practice and how much money you're making, you're going to have a discomfort that's not going to go there. And so I think the key thing is just seeking His will so that you know that you're in the right place. And when you get there, you'll know it when you feel it.
Yeah. Steve, thanks for taking some time to be with us and just kind of open our eyes to your practice and sharing the good and the bad and how God has led you and used you. And thank you for all you've done for the kingdom over the years from the exact place where God called you to be.
Thank you, David, and appreciate the time and all that you've done for the ministry of the gospel.
You know, probably another way to entitle that interview with Steve is A Missional Life, and you just sense that in what he has to say. We've got a great little resource to not only use yourself but pass on to others called A Missional Life. It came out in conjunction with our Global Missions Healthcare Conference a few years ago, but really applies to more areas than just missions. And it's a great little gift for young people that you know who are trying to decide where God wants to lead them. And I encourage you to get it. It's available here online at CMDA, or you can give us a call at 888-230-2637. Let me update you on some things coming up in the near future you may want to be part of. We've got three Grace Prescription Conferences coming up this fall, September 25th through the 26th in the Los Angeles, California area, October 23rd through the 24th in Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, North Carolina area, and November 13th through the 14th in Indianapolis, Indiana. So we've kind of spread them across the country. Now, if you've done saline solution, you need a tune-up. You need a review course. Probably more than you need a review course for your professional recertification. You need a spiritual review course to get you in tune to what God's wanting to do through your practice. Or if you've never been or know someone that hasn't been, you want to encourage them to come and be part of this life-transforming weekend where you learn how to raise faith flags, tell faith stories, build networks in your community, and really defend yourself if you're come under attack because you're doing spiritual ministry in your practice. Those dates are also online. Feel free to go to cmda.org, and right there on the front page, you'll see some advertisements about the Grace RX dates around the country. Hope to see you there. I'm on a mission. I'm on a mission to get residents and fellows to be members of CMDA. You know, we have so many students that have free membership in CMDA, and then they get busy in their third and fourth year and they kind of dwindle a little bit. But then in residency, it's the black hole. It's the pit. They disappear. They're so consumed. They're working so hard. Really during that time when they need more encouragement and resources
and networking, they don't have it. And so one of the barriers to that is, for the first time, they're starting to have to pay for this. So what we've done is drastically lowered the price and made it simpler than ever. If you're a resident, if you're a fellow, you can be a member of CMDA for $150, and that'll cover your entire residency, or it'll cover your entire fellowship. And in addition to that, you get a 10% discount at our bookstore to get resources, a 15% discount on registration at the national meeting. And you're part of this network of Christian doctors that are going through that challenging time of their life. But you have the resources you need to be successful during those years. I encourage you to do it. And if you're a graduate doctor, give it as a gift to a resident, or encourage a resident to be part of CMDA. You're often the best salesperson to let people know of the great opportunity that exists. You can do it online, or if you want to pick up the phone, 888-230-2637. Someone will help you from the membership department, and it won't take long. I hope many residents and fellows join CMDA, and my mission is accomplished. Many of you may not need an introduction. You know Bob Orr, but for the few of you who may not, Bob graduated from McGill University in 1966, practiced family practice in Vermont for 18 years, was actually named Vermont Family Doctor of the Year in 1989. He did a fellowship in ethics at the University of Chicago and then held professorships at Loma Linda University, School of Medicine, the University of Vermont College of Medicine, Trinity International University, Graduate College of Union University, where he's taught ethics and taught people how to practice ethics as not only teachers, but more importantly, as practitioners. He's lectured widely. He's co-authored 5 books, 16 book chapters, 150 articles. He's been very active in CMDA for almost 50 years, currently on the Board of Trustees. He headed up a task force that we formed a number of months ago to come up with a public policy statement on same-sex marriage, something that could actually train you how to speak about this issue into your practice, into the culture, as we face this tsunami that's come forward in really putting enormous pressure on people of faith on this issue. And it's not over yet. We still wait, as I speak today, to see what the Supreme Court's going to rule in just a month or so. Bob is the one to guide us on this issue, and let's sit down and see how we need to approach it as Christian healthcare professionals. Bob, why a statement on marriage? This really doesn't fall is one of our ethics statements, but more of a public policy one. Why did the board and organization decide we need to do something?
Well, because after, I was going to say years, but let's say millennia, of a clear understanding across societies of what marriage is, this has really been questioned and revised in, within our lifetime. And we think it's important to underscore the importance of conjugal marriage as opposed to the revisionist definitions that are coming down the pike.
And it's not just differences of opinion, I guess. It's really getting to where there's many more attacks being made in healthcare as well as in society against those who hold a different view than this new revisionist one.
Yes, and unfortunately that has happened because of the wording of the Supreme Court decision in 2013. I mean, back in 1996, when President Clinton signed DOMA, the
Defense of Marriage Act.
Defense of Marriage Act.
Yeah.
Only 27% of the U.S. population at that time supported same-sex marriage. But in 2013, when the Supreme Court overturned it, it was up to 53%. That's a major, major change in just a few years. And the wording of the Supreme Court decision said that the reason that this was happening was because of animus, of true hatred towards people of the same sex who wanted to be married. I mean, that could be said, perhaps, of the laws in the past that made illegal interracial marriages, because there really was discrimination involved there. But attacking people who defend conjugal marriage as animus as hatred is really, really scary, because that means then that the Supreme Court has said, if you discriminate against same-sex couples, then you are guilty of a hate crime.
Which in our new definition is worse than a regular crime, if it's a hate crime.
Right.
Let's step back and talk about the definition and history of marriage and how we kind of approach this. You led the group that put together this policy statement, which is just excellent, let me say. And let's kind of lay the foundation and then move on from there.
Well, marriage really was established by God millennia ago. And if we look through Scripture, it's clear that marriage is meant to be a consensual, exclusive, lifelong commitment between one man and one woman, expressed in a physical union uniquely designed to produce and nurture children. And although critics say, well, that's just a religious view, but if you look back at history, for these same millennia, this has been the societal acceptance of what marriage is, looking way back to philosophers and commentators from pre-Christian times. That's what marriage is by definition and by history. And this recent change is really a huge, rapid social and cultural revolution.
What's the underlying philosophical foundation that supports this revisionist view? I mean, what is the assumption that has to be made to get to where they're taking it?
Well, the basis is a major change in how marriage is perceived. The revisionist view is that any two individuals who are in love can be considered married, whereas the conjugal view, which we've had for thousands of years, is that it is who is in love. It's a man and a woman. And when you change the basis to just the fact of love, then you open the door to plural marriages, incest, marriages between children, and so on. But we've been using this same definition for so long, that it's a man and a woman who are committed to a lifelong relationship.
Why should the government care? I mean, you know, obviously they're very much involved in this, and that's where the hammer is on the issue, but what valid and interests do they have in this whole issue?
Well, the primary basis is that it's a civil rights issue, and the government, rightfully so, is concerned about discrimination and needs to be looking at cases of discrimination and opposing those. But discrimination is not always wrong. I mean, for a simple example, the organization MOPS, that's president of so many churches, Mothers of Preschool Children, mm-hmm. is restricted to mothers of preschool children. If somebody else tries to join, they can't join because they are discriminated against by the very basis of the definition of the organization. And if we are going to accept that the basis of the definition of marriage is one man and one woman, then anything beyond that is legitimate discrimination.
Yeah. Does the government have an interest in conjugal marriage? I mean, what's the evidence that you can bring to bear when you're in these discussions with people? Why should we promote that for good public policy?
Well, there are lots of historic reasons. Benefits of children raised by both a mother and a father, economic factors favoring father-mother families, the high cost to the government and society when marriages break down. There are just many reasons that have been shown to be true in conjugal marriage. Now, there's some speculation and some early research that portends to show equivalent benefits in same-sex marriages, but that research has been criticized for its methods and so on. But we have long-standing evidence that one man, one woman marriage is beneficial to families and society.
You know, the reason I know with the professional organizations and others is this, you know, causes lack of health care. There's all these reasons brought to bear that we need to sanction, you know, same-sex marriage. But it seems like there was other ways to get to deal with those issues without tinkering or messing up or challenging the whole concept of conjugal marriage in our culture and undermining it with new laws.
You're right. There are ways that these unjustified discriminations can be handled, such as the concern that same-sex couples may not have access to their partner in a healthcare situation. And I think that was really the basis for laws that allowed civil unions back a decade or two ago. Mm-hmm. And although this is not the position statement of CMDA, I personally would say that civil unions address the civil rights concerns, the valid civil rights concerns, but by extending that to same-sex marriage, we're really creating a whole new social endeavor.
Yeah. How's this going to affect our faith and conscience? I mean, how does this boil down to an issue that we specifically need to be concerned about in healthcare? How's it going to impact us?
Well, I think it's a critically important issue. I mean, CMDA has been saying and working for years on issues of right of conscience, and I think that if same-sex marriage is widely accepted, there's going to be a huge impact not only on us in healthcare, but on corporations and nonprofits and counseling programs. And, I mean, businesses, bakeries, photographers, florists, and so on, are going to be penalized for taking a stance in favor of traditional conjugal marriage. And in healthcare, we also could be enforced to consider questions of adoption and same-sex couples and so on. And if we are going to decline to participate in such matters, we could be lawfully accused of illegal discrimination.
And the sad thing about it, some of this is already happening. I mean, we see the evidence in the news, and Catholic adoption agencies have closed down because they won't do same-sex marriage adoptions to doctors who have been sanctioned or penalized because they would not do in vitro fertilization in a lesbian couple. I mean, the list just goes on. And let's talk about the freedom of conscience issue, because, I mean, this really gets down to First Amendment rights and the ability of free speech and free belief. But the trouble is when they've turned this into a discrimination issue, this is this new civil right. You're looked like you're a member of the Ku Klux Klan because you don't want to participate in a wedding that, as a business person, that is diametrically opposed to your religious beliefs.
Exactly. I mean, healthcare professionals have always said, along with every citizen in the country, that my personal religious beliefs are very important, and I am unwilling to be forced to practice something that is outside my religious beliefs. And when the government can come along and say, those religious beliefs don't count, we will force you to be involved because it's a matter of civil rights for everybody, this just flies in the face of professional integrity.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of confusion, too. I know when I talk about right of conscience, and you do as well, that, it's always brought up, well, you know, whether it's abortion or whatever the issue is, you just don't want to take care of these people. You just don't like these people. You just hate these people. And that's not the issue. The issue is when you're asked to participate in something that violates your beliefs. Like you have and I have, I've taken care of murderers in prison and terrorists in Africa and Islamic fundamentalists that would drop a grenade in your pocket if they saw you witnessing on the street. And I don't endorse what they do, but I provide health care for them. But it's kind of like you're taking care of an alcoholic in your office and helping them work through the issue and getting them into Alcoholics Anonymous and all this stuff. And you finish your visit, and it's the last patient of the day, and you're leaving the office, and the patient walks up to you and says, hey, doc, could you take me by the package store? I need to get something to drink. You know, and you'd say, absolutely not, because then I am participating. I am furthering something that is harmful in your life. And the same way, and as we violate our religious beliefs, that I'm going to help perform and conduct a wedding as a minister for a same-sex couple or participate in some other way in something consecrating something that absolutely opposes what I believe in.
You're right. It's a matter of moral complicity.
Yeah.
What part of my actions will facilitate an immoral act? Now, admittedly, there is some difference of opinion among Christians about where to draw that line of moral complicity. I mean, I personally, when I was doing primary care, was unwilling to sign a document allowing a patient of mine to go and have an abortion,
mm-hmm.
because I felt that putting my signature on that document was part of the act that resulted in the immoral action. Now, there are some believers who say, well, I will not do an abortion, I will not encourage abortion, but if somebody has to have, if a woman has to have my signature in order to get it done, I'm willing to do that. I personally can't do that, but there are some who would draw the line differently from how I do.
You know, one of the things, since this was a public policy statement rather than an ethics statement, and I encourage people to go to our website and download a copy of the marriage public policy statement and the same-sex marriage public policy statement. But one of the things that we did that we don't normally do with an ethics statement is there's a section on policy recommendations at the end. You want to just give us an overview of some of those?
Yes, this was very much, we were very much helped by Jonathan Imbody in putting this part of the, well, he helped with the whole policy, but with this part in particular because of his familiarity with how the nation works. So the policy recommendations include legislative measures that the legislature can do to support conjugal marriage and executive actions that might be done through government organizations, grant programs, and so on, and also judicial interpretations and rulings and regulatory measures, and then right down home, professional organizations and institutional policies. We support those that protect individuals and organizations who hold a conjugal view of marriage and sex by prohibiting discrimination against them, such as withholding of certification, licensure, advancement, office holding, or other privileges or benefits.
I think one of the great concerns I have, and I think you share with me, we were already seeing a lot of encroachment in discrimination against faith-based healthcare professionals because of their views on abortion. I think the risk and challenges very quickly are going to even be greater in this area than they are on the abortion issue, because at least there's some evidence in law that you shouldn't be doing this, even though there's not good protection as far as consequences if you discriminate. But I think here it could just be open season on faith-based healthcare professionals on this issue that's really going to affect us. So I don't know. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I absolutely do. I think this is much broader, has much greater impact than the very considerable concerns about abortion.
Yeah. Well, that's why we took the time, and Bob, I appreciate you providing the leadership to put this together, and we've just highlighted some of the things, but there's good references and scripture and things like that that'll help people on looking at this from a faith-based, and then also how to more articulately state their position when they're called to task on this. And then CMDA stands ready with our legal partners that we work with on right of conscience issues to help provide protection for our members when they come up against this. But I think the other thing we all need to do is just commit this to prayer and realize it's challenging days are ahead.
Absolutely. And to follow on that, the statement that we put together on the definition of marriage has a lot of scriptural references. The public policy statement on same-sex marriage has less in the way of scriptural references because it's really meant for a broader audience. And I think there's adequate justification outside biblical references to our position.
Yeah, yeah. And we need to know how to support our position in the public square where scripture verse isn't going to be as helpful. Bob, thanks for taking time to be with us and for all you've done for many decades now. I guess we have been working together for that long. And just so appreciate your leadership and your wisdom and your courage and your unrelenting efforts on a wide range of ethical issues. Thanks for taking some time to be with me.
You're welcome, and thanks for calling.
If you'd like a copy of our same-sex marriage and just our straight marriage statement, they're available online, free. Go to cmda.org, go to the members-only section, use your password. If you've forgotten it, there's an easy way that they'll send that to your email and you can get online. It's something you should download. In fact, you may want to download all our ethical statements and keep them handy, because we're facing so many issues of medicine. And these short statements, sometimes that take years to put together, a page or two pages, concisely look at the biblical perspective, the moral perspective, the ethical perspective, and teach you how to articulate your views in the public square. Also encourage you to get a copy of Bob's book, Medical Ethics and the Faith Factor. It's a handbook for clergy and healthcare professionals, a series of case studies from his practice of clinical ethics for many years. They make you think. They educate you. I keep a copy of this book right behind my desk and refer to it often. On the same-sex marriage issue, we've got a great little resource called Same-Sex Marriage, A Thoughtful Approach to God's Design for Marriage. All these resources are available at 888-230-2637. Give us a call. One of our staff will be happy to help you. Or you can just go online and order at cmda.org. And guess what? After you give us your credit card, it shows up in your mailbox just a few days later. And it'll be a great resource for you to use in what you're doing every day. I want to encourage you, as we look at all the changes and the challenges and the constants in healthcare, these are days of angst among healthcare professionals. We just did a little mini survey a couple months ago asking our members what was going on in their life, and it was just a deluge of, I'm quitting medicine, I'm stressed, I'm changing my practice style, I'm leaving this, I'm going to that. I'm depressed, I'm angry, it went on and on. And as I was thinking about that and reading through those comments, and I read every one of them, I just thought, boy, we need to be encouraging. And remember this, that God is faithful. God's not surprised by this. And God has allowed this to happen. He's put us in this day and time for a purpose. It's not that we need to win these battles. We need to be faithful. That's what God asks us to do. The battle is the Lord's, but we need to be faithful voices into our culture and into our profession. And we may be persecuted for it. That shouldn't discourage us. That should make us afraid. Blessed are those when people shall revile you and persecute you. The Bible is very clear that this is part of normal Christian living, is that people will misunderstand you, people will persecute you, they will retaliate against you, and then it says, have joy. Be glad when that happens, because you're experiencing what God's Son experienced when he came to earth, and God will bless you for what happens to you. So it's not time to run. It's not time to be depressed. It's not time to discourage. In fact, one of the things that can be so helpful as we go through this is to count your blessings. You remember that old song, Count Your Blessings, Name Them One by One? I was listening to a speaker this weekend, and she wrote a book, A Thousand Gifts, and talked about how counting blessings gives you joy in the midst of difficult time. And she even advocated setting down and writing out 1,000 different blessings, from the beautiful morning sunrise to the joy that your pet brings you, to God's presence as you pray, to blessings that have happened in your life, the things that God showers us on. And as we focus on the blessings, the difficulties just begin to fade away. Oh, they're still there, and we still have to deal with them, but we see something so much greater, so much more important in our lives, that the problems become smaller as we realize God's wonderful gifts to us. I challenge you to do that. Today, start it. Maybe as you have your devotions, which I trust you're having almost every day you can, and just get a piece of paper and jot down 2 or 3 blessings today, gifts that God has given you, your children, your warm home, your practice, the opportunity to touch people's lives every day. We could just go down the list and make 100 right here as we finish up this Christian Doctor's Digest. And then think about him on that day and what God has done in your life. The gift of salvation, the gift of health, the gift of friendship. Those things will encourage you as we go forward into difficult days, knowing that God is present that he gives us so much more than he challenges with, and that he uses every challenge to deepen our walk with him. Yeah, growth days are ahead. That's the good news. And be assured that we here at CMDA stand with you. If you have a need, a concern, a prayer request, don't hesitate to drop us an email, give us a call. We want to put resources into your hand to counsel you, to help you in any way we can. That's why we exist. I and all my staff, we work for you. And as God is faithful, we'll gather around the throne one day to praise his name for what he's done during these days. Till we get a chance to get together again, I trust God will be present in your life and you'll reach out and grab onto him in a new and more complete way. And he will meet your need.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.